This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
A quick warning. This podcast contains strong language and some descriptions of violence. From BBC Sounds and BBC Radio 5 Live, I'm Livvy Haydock, and this is Gangster, the story of Viv Graham. Episode 6, Legacy.
It was a grey day, it wasn't raining, it was cold. This was New Year's Day. You know, on New Year's Day, if you go into any street, it's silent. This is because everybody's still in bed, nursing heads that are throbbing. It was quiet. There were no crowds. It wasn't like sometimes you see on the television when there's crowds of people standing at the ticker tape. There was nothing. It was absolutely silent street, the haunted look, if you like.
Dr. John McCarthy, a forensic pathologist, has just arrived at the scene of Viv Graham's murder.
I remember being met by the scene of crimes officers, as they were called in those days. In Northumbria Police, a homicide was always dealt with by a superintendent, so I remember meeting the superintendent. We walked the scene where the incident occurred.
Were you familiar with the name Viv Graham?
Viv Graham was a person of notoriety in the northeast of England who lived in the east end of Newcastle. I lived in the east end of Newcastle. So he was a person who was known, a character. Because I worked as a forensic pathologist, I had already encountered other members of his fraternity who had come to traumatic ends of their lives.
Over the course of his career, Dr. McCarthy did more than 30,000 autopsies. And he says Viv's was actually pretty straightforward.
The wounds to Mr. Graham were to the upper parts of the legs and to the lower pelvis. And the damage, essentially, was vascular damage, where these bullets had damaged major arterial structures. So the cause of death was relatively straightforward. He bled to death.
Dr. McCarthy had dealt with many gunshot cases. So what did he make of Viv Graham's death?
Well, my thoughts, of course, can't be substantiated, but the bullet wounds were in an unusual location where the primary purpose was to kill somebody. People who are shot to be killed, it's usually a chest wound or the head. It crossed my mind that maybe the purpose of shooting Mr. Graham was as a warning or a punishment rather than to kill him.
We're told that the calibre of weapon used was a 357 Magnum, which is rather large, I think.
As far as I'm aware, the gun was never discovered, and the calibre of the bullets was the assessment. It depends what guns are available in the criminal community, obviously. You use what is available.
Three shots were fired at Viv Graham. He was hit in the stomach. He staggered and collapsed near Wallsend High Street. Flowers marked the place where he fell.
While all of this was going on, people across the city were waking up to the news of Viv Graham's death. One of them was Julie Bradford, who was a reporter at the local paper, The Chronicle. She arrived at work on New Year's Day with an absolute stinker of a hangover.
It was the big market for us as young women. There was loads of new wine bars opening that were kind of less scary than the old-style boozers. So we used to come, you never wore a coat, you'd wear miniskirts and hot pants in the middle of winter, and you'd just have a high old time. It was great.
And so what happened that New Year's Eve? I mean, can you remember where you went?
Absolutely not. I lived in the city centre, so I could stagger home from anywhere. So I don't remember where I went. I just remember how dreadful I felt the next day. I went into work. I didn't know that anything was up. The acting news editor of the day said, don't bother taking your coat off. They sort of told us what had happened. Everybody'd heard of Viv Graham, and it was a big shock.
Who was Viv Graham? What was your understanding of Viv Graham?
We always called him a hard man. It's like calling somebody a militant rather than a terrorist. You try not to upset people on either side. And so he was a Tyneside hard man.
Define our Tyneside hard man.
Somebody pumped up, very muscly, laddish. There was a very masculine culture at the time. And always some people loved them and thought they were Robin Hood type figures, and some people hated them.
For the local paper, this story was simply huge, and Julie, throbbing head and all, was dispatched to Shields Road in Bicker, where I'm standing with her now. It's just down the way from Walkerville, where Viv lived with Anna, and it was one of his strongholds. Even today, there are a good number of old-school boozers on this road, and back then, there were many more.
So I was sent out to come to Shields Road, go into all the pubs and find out what the reaction was from landlords and bar people and any punters who were around in the pubs. I felt miserable and ill, and going into pubs with that smell of last night's lager sort of didn't do my stomach any good. But the adrenaline on these stories always kind of gets you through.
Got to say, I don't envy her. She was being asked to go looking for stories in one of Viv's heartlands just hours after he'd been killed.
The pubs were really quiet. People were very cagey and very tense because it had just happened and nobody knew quite what to expect next.
And what do you mean by that? Did you think perhaps people were thinking there's going to be a retaliation or...?
Retaliation, what would they do without the protection? Who would move in next to try and take over Viv Graham's sort of power base?
There is concern now that Viv Graham's death has left a power vacuum in Newcastle's criminal world. Police will be watching carefully to see if any rival gangs attempt to pick up where he left off.
And those fears were real, as one publican told the local BBC News in the aftermath of Viv's killing.
Managers, manageresses feel very vulnerable. Customers feel unsafe. We just don't know what's going to happen. We don't know who's trying to take over. We don't know what at the present time. They think they can come in here and take your bar over, they can smash up the place and that you won't do anything about it. But they're wrong, because we will.
Peter Connolly was one of the landlords targeted by wannabe racketeers who were looking to move in on Viv's territory. Peter, though, a man who had spent time in jail for violence and involvement in a counterfeit cash racket, was not going to roll over. And when one man who he suspected, rightly or wrongly, of involvement in Viv's killing turned up at his pub demanding money, he took matters into his own hands.
I hate them, I can't stand them. I tried to kill him myself. I did, I got to go and I went to shoot him.
Can I ask what that was about?
Well, he come for the protection money, didn't he? He came to all the bars. He was the one that wanted the protection money. So he come to my bar. And I had the gun. And I went to shoot him, but I didn't know the safety catch was on. I would have shot him. I would have gladly shot him.
Extreme reactions like that showed just why police had to get a grip on this situation. Northumbria Police Superintendent Eric Mock, who was the area commander for neighbouring Wall's End, spoke to the BBC after Viv's death.
Since Viv Graham's death, in the Wall's End area, we have had specific approaches to some publicans, not many, but to some. And some of those publicans have been threatened with violence. Knives have been produced on one occasion, and a gun was produced on another occasion.
But the people you're talking about are sort of would-be Viv Graham successors?
Some of them would be. There's different types of protection. There's been a number of different types of approach. One is, yes, I'll come and do the business for you and take the place of Viv Graham, or try to take the place of Viv Graham. The second one, and the far more dangerous one, is Viv Graham's not here. I'm here. Give me money, or else we're going to destroy your premises and damage yourself.
The murder of Viv Graham was one of the most high-profile investigations in Northumbria Police's history. The killing had happened in the early evening on New Year's Eve, close to a busy high street. There must have been loads of people around.
Police believe a man left the pub where Viv Graham was drinking at about 6:05, minutes before the murder. He then walked past the place where the killers may have been waiting. He's described as...
But detectives were up against it from the very beginning.
Detectives are concerned that fear surrounding the shooting is dissuading witnesses from coming forward.
It's a frightening thought to have someone shot on Moors End High Street and people are frightened and we're anxious that they come forward to see us and speak to us and let us analyse whatever information they have.
Despite these difficulties, within a month, police had suspects in custody for questioning.
Tonight, four men and a woman are being questioned here at Moors End Police Station, not far from the spot where Viv Graham was shot. The police are saying very little about this latest development in their investigation. But they have confirmed...
Those trails, though, went cold. Other appeals and lines of inquiry also went nowhere. Meanwhile, in the days and weeks following Viv's murder, Anna couldn't cope. She says she was heavily medicated and recalls little other than vivid dreams in which Viv returned to her. The police had an officer in her home, and she said she later discovered a property across the road was being used for surveillance. In her waking moments, she was tortured by questions which can never be answered.
He keeps saying, if only, if he just hadn't went there, if I hadn't said go for the dog food. But it doesn't matter because it had to happen and it happened.
Among the criminal gangs operating in Newcastle, Viv Graham's death spelled opportunity, especially when it came to getting drugs into the clubs. Chet Sandu, the fashion shop owner turned criminal, watched on as the city's underworld manoeuvred.
The reaction was, it was like bigger than the Queen dying, I would say. Everybody was just like in shock mode. How has this happened? Who's done it? What happens now? For somebody of his stature to get shot is like a really, really big move at the time. A lot of people got nicked. A lot of my friends got pulled in, just if you were associated with guns. They were pulling everybody in who had a link with guns.
So what happens then when you remove Viv Graham from the scene?
If you remove somebody like that who is in total control of places, then you will get other ones who rise up, families that rise up. It's similar to like what's happened in Iraq and that when they took out Saddam Hussein. If you take out the top guy and he had control of that country, everybody was terrified of him. I know he was bad and what he did, but he had control of that country. And then when you took him out, that's when you got the Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, all these other groups. They all rise up now because they all want a slice of that.
There was never going to be another Viv Graham or anyone like him. In fact, Chet says nobody wanted to take it all because one man trying to control so much alone was never going to end well. Chet, who began working on the Doors himself, said the real battle among rival criminal gangs was to control the supply of drugs into the most lucrative clubs and bars.
They would do things what wouldn't normally happen. Take over clubs, do this, do that, start selling the drugs. Other people would move in selling drugs. It all went a bit haywire, and it went a bit haywire in every part, on all the club scene, the nightclub scene, which I was involved in then. So it had a knock-on effect. Everybody wanted a piece of the action. So this is when drugs in Newcastle flooded. It just, bam, it was everywhere.
In the years after Viv Graham's murder, Chet himself became a major player. His fashion shop was gone, and he had picked up a conviction for running a credit card fraud racket. Now working as a doorman, he spotted a niche he could carve out for himself, importing and selling steroids.
I was bringing it in small amounts at first, just from Spain, Turkey, things like that, selling it to my fellow doorman pals. So I thought, right, there's a market here, because what's getting sold at the minute and what was getting taken is just shit. So the market I seen was to bring it in myself and go to the suppliers where it's originally made and bring in the real deal.
Chet began going direct to the manufacturers in Pakistan. He says he formed a business relationship with criminal groups which controlled the supply. It was the start of a lucrative business. He became known as the King of Karachi.
It was 50,000 ampules of steroids at first, and then I started to bring in Valium, which was the main moneymaker, which was the pill people used to take after taking ecstasy. And the market on that was even bigger. So I flooded the market up here with blues as well. I was like a one-stop shop, whether you wanted slimming pills, Viagra, cutters up, bulkers, this, that. I had the full works. So the money then was really good. Safety deposit boxes I had then. You didn't used to have to give any ID, really, to open up a box. And £20 notes, they were all full of. I had to change them to £50 notes because there was no space in the boxes. That was the amount of money that was coming in at a time, and nobody else really could do what I was doing.
In 1999, Chet was arrested at gunpoint at Alicante Airport with $500,000 worth of black market pharmaceutical drugs. He was sentenced to 4.5 years in one of Spain's toughest jails.
The prison was really, really bad. I was stabbed there twice. I stabbed somebody there. It was all heavy people there.
How did you get by?
First, yeah, it was horrible because I was on the come down from the steroids at first as well. I went in, I was 16 and a half stone, and then I got hooked on the heroin in there. Everybody was smoking heroin, but then I packed it all in, and then I started to train there, started to eat the shit food, and I just built myself back up from there, and then I became the money lender on the wing. So then I made it work for me once I learned the language.
After Chet got out, he joined up with a gang in Gateshead, which ran nightclub doors and prostitution rings. Chet also ran his own sideline, trafficking cocaine. All of this was enforced with a savage level of violence. By now, this was a good decade since Viv's murder, but Chet is clear that he wouldn't have had such a clear run if Viv had still been around.
We just thought we could just do what the fuck we wanted, with no fear of anybody, which wasn't what it was like when Viv was around, you know, because he had control of everything, really. The drugs I was selling everywhere, I didn't care about anybody else. I did get told that I was selling drugs in a place where somebody else was selling. I said, I couldn't give a fuck. What are you going to do about it?
A second prison sentence of 6.5 years was inevitable. This time, it was enough to see him turn his back on crime. And today, his life is very different.
Life now is good. I'm just getting on with things now, legally and straight. And you don't have the drama of working in that illegal world where you don't know what's going to happen, where it could be any knock on the door. It could be another gangster firm, or it could be the police, or it could be anything, yeah, because that's what life is like then. It's on a daily thing. I think jail, the second sentence I did, taught me a lesson. Jail worked on that part for me. I did every course going. I kept myself straight. I was off the steroids, off the drugs. I didn't do anything in there. And I said to myself, I ain't going to come back here again because it's just too much. It's just a fucking waste of fucking life.
In those intervening years, one of the most high-profile murder investigations in Northumbria Police's history rolled on. Officers are reported to have interviewed more than 1,000 people, visited at least 500 homes, and made countless arrests. None of these leads went anywhere, and as the years became decades, the trail went quiet. Viv Graham's life and death, though, continued to cast a long shadow, especially over the children he'd left behind. How old were you, Viv, when you lost your dad?
I was 4. Yeah, I was 4. I was very young. That's why I don't have many memories, which is sad. But yeah, I was four and life was different after that.
Did you understand, as you were getting older, why your dad wasn't there?
I was always led to believe that he was an enforcer. He'd done what he'd done, keeping people out the bars. And then it turned to people telling us it was drugs that he used to keep out the bars. And as I've grown up, people come to us and said it was actually him that was dealing the drugs, which I didn't believe.
Viv Jr.'s brother Dean was 4 years older than him. Their dad's death hit him particularly hard.
He understood a lot more. He read into things a lot more. And he was a different kid. He wasn't the same kid as I remember being young. He grew up to be something he shouldn't have been. He went to jail a lot of times. He caused a lot of grief in my house as he grew up.
Is there something you'd blame it on?
Just understanding what had happened. He struggled for a lot of years, and that's why he turned to the drugs. He couldn't cope. I was angry seeing him like that, but I brought him round a couple of times. He was on heroin, and he used to keel over. I didn't know what was happening, but I was frightened, you know. It was a scary scene to be around.
It was a spiral Dean could not escape from. In March 2010, he was found dead in his car on an industrial estate close to where he lived in Highfield. He'd taken an overdose.
How old was Dean?
Dean was 24. He was 24 when he died. He was still young. You know, he had all his life ahead of him. He had a daughter. She was 18 months. And it must have been hard for his partner. And obviously it's going to be hard for his daughter growing up, hearing stories again. It's like a vicious circle. So she hears all the stories about her granddad and now all the stories about her dad.
Dean might have had a troubled life, but he was a father figure to Viv Jr. and had tried his best to be there for his little brother. Dean's death had a devastating impact on Viv. History was repeating itself.
It was like I had to deal with that. It was dealing with death all over again, so young. I struggled. I hit the drugs and I went down a bumpy road. I didn't know what to do.
Viv Jr. had been a promising boxer like his dad, but now he was using his fists for all the wrong reasons and he started racking up convictions. In 2012, he nearly died when he was ambushed and severely beaten.
It was a Wednesday afternoon. I had been to the shop. I had gotten myself some food and I was walking up the street and they jumped out of a car. I was standing in front of them and I thought it was going to be a fair fight. Next thing I know, I was woke up in an ambulance. I had a cracked skull. I don't know what that had hit us with, but it was some heavy object. They tried to break my legs. I had cuts on my legs, just above the ankle. I tried to smash my legs, but I was lucky they didn't kill us.
Viv's life was now spiralling out of control, and he was in very real danger of adding to his family's tragic history. It would take time, years in fact, but Viv summoned the strength to turn his life around. Today, he's a dad of two with a long-term partner and a steady job.
Life's great. I work full-time, go to work, come home to my family, and that's the life I like. I've been out of trouble for a long time and I don't bother with drugs, and that's the way I like it. I don't even drink.
Having your own family, has that changed how you reflect on perhaps your childhood and, you know, the dad your dad was?
Well, I don't want my son or my daughter growing up to believe I was bad. I want them grown up properly. I don't want them turning into something that I was or Dean was or me dad was. Life's different for them. I go to work and I come back. It's not Toys R Us every Saturday, I can tell you that.
Anna Connolly has also done her best to build a new life.
Oh, they're so cute, the dogs.
She loves her pets. All the time we've been chatting, her blind German shepherd called Skye has been lying at her feet. Her other dog, Coco, is curled up on the sofa. If she's not out walking them, she's running her dog grooming business. Her and her brother Peter are still as thick as thieves and regularly meet for a catch-up at the Queen's Head pub in Wallsend. But so often the conversation returns to Viv, and the New Year's Eve night they can never forget.
At 12 o'clock, I'll see me prayers and I think, like the people who killed him, what are you thinking now? That person who pulled that trigger 3 times and hit him, that person must, on New Year's Eve, remember that. Every little detail. You could never forget that. And then knowing on the news that you'd murdered him. For what? For what? What the heck did he do so badly that he shoot him down like that with a 357 Magnum? Got away with it as well for 30 years. Still getting away with it.
Northumbria Police has set up a cold case team to investigate major unsolved crimes. The members of Viv's family we spoke to haven't heard from them, and the police did not want to be interviewed for this podcast. But Peter Connolly, like so many other people I've spoken to making this series, has a theory as to who was there that night. And he says now, after 30 years, people are starting to talk.
We put the money up for the reward at the time, hoping that somebody would say something then, but they never did. Nobody come forward. But I think now, if somebody was to put a £10,000 reward, like the police or whatever, I think they would tell on them straight away, because they've got no money. Everybody knows who done it, so definitely another reward would make some tongues waggle. It's not just the ones who done it, it's the ones who paid for it. It's the ones I really want to catch.
When was the last time you were here?
Probably a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not somewhere I like to come, you know. Mm. But we'll go and have a look.
Yeah.
I'll show you where they're buried.
Thanks, Viv.
I'm back with Viv Jr. and we're at St Patrick's Church near Highfield, walking up a gravel path towards the cemetery. Over to my left is the church itself, a little picture postcard stone chapel, which has barely changed since it opened in 1890. Straight ahead are rows upon rows of manicured graves leaning into a steep hill with sweeping views of the Derwent Valley. This is Viv Graham's final resting place, alongside his eldest son, Dean.
Just here. This is where they're buried. This is my brother's grave, Dean.
So this one's Dean?
This one's Dean's, yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah, and this is my dad's.
And there's a picture of a man boxing on the tombstone.
That's him, aye. Simply the best.
Ah, it says simply the best at the bottom of the tombstone.
Yeah, it does, aye.
Why simply the best?
Well, he was simply the best, wasn't he, at one point? It was his favourite song.
He went bang, bang, bang. The three of them were lying there, out.
For 30 years, Viv Jr. has lived with the devastating legacy of his dad's murder.
It was the power, the presence, the aura, the size of him.
He who rides a tiger can never dismount, because the tiger will eat you.
To him, the legends, stories, debates about who his dad was and why he died don't matter. They never did. He was his dad, and he wasn't there when he needed him most.
He used to always say, I'll be dead by the time I'm 40. And sure enough, he was.
But Viv has broken that cycle. He's building a new legacy and a better future for his young family. Later this year, he'll turn 35, meaning he'll have outlived both his dad and his big brother.
What would it mean to you and your family, Viv, if your father's death was solved? Because he's never had justice, has he?
No, he hasn't, no. I've just spoken to my grandma before she died. She would like to see justice, you know. Everyone would like to see justice, but well, that happens or not, it's out of our hands.
Gangster, the story of Viv Graham. Thanks so much for listening to the end. We hope you enjoyed the series. If you did, please rate wherever you get your podcasts. Go to BBC Sounds to listen to our other gripping gangster stories. The stories of Paul Massey, Curtis Warren, John Palmer, and the Burger Bar Boys are all available now. This podcast was made by BBC Radio 5 Live for BBC Sounds. I'm Livy Haydock. The series producer is Ben Robinson. The producer is Patrick Kightley. Technical production and sound design is by Richard Hannaford. The journalism assistant is Tim Fernley. The commissioning executive for BBC Sounds and Radio 5 Live is Louise Cattenhorn. The Assistant Commissioner is Lorraine Aquefina. The Editor and Executive Producer, Claire Fordham.
Curls it forward, is able to chest it down.
Welcome to You'll Never Beat Kyle Walker.
Walker is in on the challenge with him, shoulder to shoulder. Walker starts us brilliantly, brilliantly.
I'm Kyle Walker, Man City and England right back.
And I'm Chris Hughes, and each week Kyle and I are going to kick back and talk football. We'll tell stories of the beautiful game, dig through Kyle's footballing journey and find out what it takes to win.
A lot.
That's excellent.
From BBC Radio 5 Live. You'll never beat Kyle Walker. Listen on BBC Sounds.